Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome to today's podcast. I am excited and delighted to be speaking with Professor David Clutterbuck, author, mentor, supervisor, coach, lecturer, and I'm sure there are lots of other things in there that you do, David. It'd be great if you could give us maybe a bit of an introduction of yourself and what you do.
Yeah, you missed off children's author and stand-up comic as well. So I often describe myself as one of, if not the last man standing from the original pioneers of coaching and mentoring. Having been in this particular field, a fascinating field of research and study and practice since the late 1970s. So it's been a fascinating journey for me, seeing the evolution of both coaching and mentoring together, intertwined and as well. And looking for the evidence base behind things, moving from nice assumptions that people make, because I do it this way, this must be the right way to do it, saying, okay, where's the evidence for this? You know, what actually stands up? And so often we find that it's counterintuitive. Much of the stuff we get taught at a very simple level just isn't true and isn't helpful. So the growth of a coach or the growth of a mentor has been a fascinating area for me, and it's an area that I continue to research in.
And it's really interesting as you talk about the sort of the research and the change and growth over time. I'm sort of wondering sort of what was there in the early days that people thought about coaching that now we're just kind of going, that's just so far away from what we thought.
Well, one of the first things was that the coaching is a relative newcomer. You know, we only see the word in 1851, or the word coach appear in 1851 when it was a joke. In the novel Pendennis, a bunch of students were going back to Oxford University or Cambridge University, I forget which, but they were transported in a rather expensive carriage, because only really wealthy people would go to university. And they had spent their entire 2 years or so up at university basically getting drunk and getting laid. And so here they were, suddenly needed to get their exams. And so one of them says, I'm all right. I've got myself a tutor. And it cost me a lot of money, but it doesn't matter. You know. But he's going to get me through my examinations. He's going to tell me what to do and how to pass the examination. Mm. So it's fine. I'm okay. And I think of him like a coach, because basically it's like having a bit like traveling in luxury and being dragged along by a bunch of horses, you know, being transported in through my example. And that was coaching that originated there. And then it went to rowing first and then to tennis. And when they started having rowing coaches, there was a big debate. Was it fair to have a coach to give you an unfair advantage? Did it give you an unfair advantage? Was it ungentlemanly or unsportsmanlike? Then it got to tennis. And then, you know, sort of 100 years later, we get Timothy Galway going to India and discovering that there are different ways to coach people. And bring down his book in the mid-70s that started the process of rethinking what coaching looked like and was. Meanwhile, we've got all the vast tradition of mentoring going on. Right way, sort of 800, 900 years BC was when it first started to be written down. So an oral tradition of wisdom. And the original mentor was the goddess Athena, the goddess of wisdom, who sat down with Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, and with Odysseus himself. They had some adventures. They got up to stuff. They felt sorry for themselves, and Athena would sit down with them in the guise of an old man called Mentor, and she would talk them through, and they'd learn from the thinking about their experiences. They would become wiser. So the whole role of a mentor was to somebody who's there who uses their wisdom to help you become wiser yourself. We sort of wind forward a couple of thousand years to the court of King Louis XIV, the Sun King in France. And you've got this this young prince who's a total, utter little brat. And of course, because he's a prince, nobody can give him a good clip around the ears. not that we're allowed to do that anymore anyway, but still. So they brought in this French cleric called Fenelon, who did the same as Athena. Sat him down and talked to him about his behavior and his experiences, and basically turned him into a wise young man. And he wrote a book. He wrote a book continuing the dialogues of Athena with Telemachus, in which he basically modernized the whole thing. And it was a sort of textbook for leadership. It was the first, probably if you discount Machiavelli, it was the first textbook on leadership in Europe. And what that did, it went viral, and that was this notion of helping somebody through questions and through reflection to grow up and to become more mature. That was where mentoring came from. Now we wind forward again, and we get to the beginnings of formal mentoring in the late 1970s, we created mentoring programs, so people got mentors. Well, originally it was just for an elite, and then it got expanded out. So it was an instrument of diversity. So first women, and then racial and cultural minorities, and then much wider. So mentoring sort of grew in this way as formal programs, and that created a whole load of different options for people. And there's hundreds of wonderful programs around, thousands and thousands of wonderful programs around the world, which are really contributing to social mobility, to people becoming wiser leaders, and taking more and having better career chances. And coaching started to borrow those behaviors of conversation from mentoring. And because in America they had a strange, they mixed up sponsorship and mentoring and trouble is when you put those two, somebody's your sponsor and somebody's trying to be your mentor, you've got a conflict here because somebody's your sponsor, you're not going to be totally honest with them. You're not going to, it just isn't going to work. So the two constructs work against each other. They completely missed the point about what mentoring was there for. So it became an instrumental thing about using your power to help someone, to pluck somebody out of obscurity. As the heroic leader, you would take this young person who had nothing going for them, and you would then remake them in your image so that they had a successful career, and all of this stuff. And that's the American model. I relate it very closely to, the American culture at that time was very much about expansion, about being the dominant world power, and it's part of that cultural identity. But in Europe, of course, mentoring stayed the way it always had been, a reflective dialogue, and helping people to think for themselves. And so we get this conflict between mentoring and coaching. Because we get coaches, the origins of coaching becomes solidified as a profession or a business in the States. And then when that comes across to Europe, of course, there's an immediate clash between coaches educated in the States who've got one idea of what coaching and mentoring is, and people in Europe who are saying, no, that's wrong. You've got it the wrong way around. Eventually this all came together, and what we now realize is that coaching and mentoring are two very closely identified issues, that neither of them is directive, that they are both about helping people, supporting people in that quality of thinking.
That's beautiful. That's like a snapshot history of coaching and mentoring in a few sentences. And as you were talking, the idea of this kind of the myths and the history, the tales that we draw upon in coaching, it definitely sort of in that space around metaphors was coming to mind. These you know, gods showing up as wise men, and how that kind of plays out a metaphor for us in terms of our thinking, but also this, the idea of the art of it, the art of coaching, the art of mentoring, that it's, that there is a quality to it, or refinedness to it, that really plays into this, this idea that this is something that is a craft that we spend time developing. It's not something that just appears overnight, but it's a lifetime's journey, I guess.
Absolutely. It's not a process. And that's one of the big problems is so many coaches see coaching as a process and then something you do to people. And it's much closer to improvisation when it's done well than almost anything else. It is artistry. And so in the research that we've been doing over the last 15, 20 years, we've been looking deeply at the nature of the transitions that coaches go through as they become more experienced, more mature. And just like adults go through stages of cognitive and socio-emotional maturity, coaches do the same. They typically will start off with a, they'll be given a toolbox, and typically the GROW model, which and basically the GROW model is like, it's basically giving somebody a hammer and saying, see what you can do with that. knock your client into shape. it's very clunky. It doesn't work when things get messy. And what you're doing there with GROW model type coaching or similar other models, you're dragging the client through a process that they've got each step has got to, you know, is preordained. You move from this step to the next step to the next step. And gradually coaches learn that actually it isn't that sequential. It isn't linear. And then they gradually realize that it isn't enough anyway. And one of the big things that we see, this great myth, you've got to start with a SMART goal. But the research shows us very clearly that actually in effective coaching, the goals are emergent. If you've still got the same goal without any deviance with that goal at the end of the coaching relationship that you did at the beginning, you haven't been coaching, or you're unlikely to have been coaching. What has to happen is that as the person understands their internal world and the external world much more, they will increasingly shift their perception of the goal. It will evolve into something different. And one study from the States of 200 coaches in the States, and coaches in the States tend to be much more goal obsessed than Europe. That found 192 of the coaches said, yeah, the goal would rarely be the same at the end of the relationship as at the beginning of the relationship. So this whole thing about goal focus, all this, you need something to hang on to. It's like having stabilizers on the bike. But you know, if you want to go and compete in the Olympics, you can't still keep your stabilizers. You've got to let them off at some stage. and so you move from doing coaching to people to what we call process-based, which is doing coaching with people.
Yeah. I think back to my own journey as a coach. And I remember when I first started out and I learned the GROW model. And so every client had to fit, because I only had one model. Yeah. So whatever they presented had to fit within that model. And I look back now and just kind of cringe at some of the work that I was doing. But, you know, those were the tools that you had at that time, 15 years ago or whatever it was, trying to make something happen. But as you learn more about coaching and you develop as a coach, the artistry starts to kick in. And I think it's a little bit like we start off coloring by numbers, and then we remove the numbers, we remove the lines, and that flow starts to take place, and we can sort of be in a space without fear. Because I think a lot of coaches, when they first start, there's a little bit of fear and anxiety about, am I going to get this right?
Yeah.
Even though my trainers and tutors have told me there is no right and wrong, there is the process, there's what's happening, and but we still have this, am I getting it right? And then I think you get to a space where you go, well, actually, I can sit here comfortably and be in dialogue with somebody and being improvisation and being that witness with someone and allow that to grow and emerge into the space.
Well, we're actually doing a major study now. We're asking very, very experienced coaches to reflect back on their journey and capturing the themes from how they move from that beginner level to this much more experienced coach level. And the two themes that come out very clearly are letting go. So letting go of control, letting go of the need to have a question, and reflection. So to really deep reflection and thinking about the process that you've gone through. Mm. And when you go through the last two levels that we've been able to identify, the third level is philosophy based, we call it. And what happens there is you get so much confidence and so many tools and such that you start using fewer and fewer tools. And then that happens. The more experience you get, the more tools you have, and the fewer tools you use. But you start to integrate who you are with what you do as a coach. And then the final stage, we call it systemic eclectic. You're able to see the client and their and everything that's going on around them in systemic terms. You see the interconnectedness of things. And the wonderful thing that we see, we notice about these systemic eclectic coaches, and we describe them as holding the client while the client has the conversation they need to have with themselves. And the immense calm that you see in the room when these coaches are working with somebody, but the degree of energy, you know, the connectedness, the quality of the energy between the client and the coach is enormous. I mean, I sometimes say you could put a light bulb in the middle and it would flash. Simply because of that concentration, that relaxation, knowing that you don't have to have a pull out at all, knowing you don't have to have a question, because when it's needed, the right question will arise. All of that things, that confidence, that's, I think, an important part. And we're increasingly finding that the more mature you get, the more you use yourself, and the more you use your experience, and that the most mature coaches actually combine coaching, or pure coaching, if you like, with mentoring, where they're actually using their own experience to create and craft better questions, to create that deeper connectedness and emotional link with the other person because they've been there in similar situations. So that there's this evolution of basically just relaxing into it and having genuine human conversations. We think there might be a fifth level, but we're not sure. And in that fifth level, we still to see it emerge. But what happens when humans and artificial intelligence get closer together? When we really do with an AI, and there are all sorts of issues here. Like, how do we stop ourselves being overwhelmed with data from an AI? Or how do we? What's going to happen if you're a beginner coach? You're going to find that the AI takes over and runs the conversation, and you haven't got very much to do. We're still speculating about this next level of coach maturity, but it's going to be very interesting to explore when it happens.
And it's something really sort of fascinating about the relationship between the maturity of the coach and the trainer or the training environment, because often a trainer of coaching has gone through these levels. And so when they're demonstrating coaching, that they have this relaxedness because they've reached that philosophy-based way of working or that systemic way of working. But the newbie hasn't got there yet. And so he's seeing something that they sometimes think of as magic or as bewildering of how are you asking those questions or how are you landing in that place? And I think there's something where we have to be really clear about the time it takes to get to that space and the journey of arriving into that relaxed space with coaching.
Yeah, there's a great book by a guy called David Epstein called Range, which is a fairly recent book, and what the thesis he develops there is that all this stuff about 10,000 hours, the Malcolm Gladwell stuff, is actually only true in a very small number of professions and activities. What makes mastery is this eclecticism. Mm. So you're bringing into your practice as a coach things from all over the place. So different bits of knowledge, neuroscience, family therapy, you name it, but you have a wide range of interests, and they develop a wider sense of your identity as a coach that allows you to call upon all sorts of things, most of which are not in the coaching textbooks. So it's the more of yourself and your unique mixture of knowledge and understanding. I mean, we basically acquire this by getting older, by reading a lot more, by going on courses, by supervision, all those kind of things help. I like to go into a large bookstore, when those that still exist, and stand in the middle of the fiction section, the non-fiction section, and I turn myself around several times and point randomly. And then I go and look at the books in that section. It's great fun. The example I like to use is taking down a book on origami and looking at the metaphors that come out of that for the way for nested systems and how you know, and the conversations you have with a client about the systems that they are a part of.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when I first started coaching, I read lots of stuff around coaching and felt that was the only way to develop as a coach. And then as I grew as a coach, it was recognizing that other influence in my life actually played a larger impact on my coaching. And I guess there's this thing of you need the stabilizers to start with and those frameworks. And then as you get more steady and you find your balance, then you can pull in all these different plates that you can spin. Sort of recognizing that my acting career and improvisation came back into my coaching as I developed as a coach that hadn't been there at the beginning, that I'd almost put to one side.
I think it's wonderful to see the way that mature coaches are so playful. I've been working with some students, some PhD students around playfulness. They're doing a study around that, and this ability just to be light and have that deftness of touch, to be moved and to actually to laugh at things. You know, the different quality of emotional pace in the room. These are all part of the movement of shadow, the dance that we have as a coach and coachee. And I think it's being able to go into enormous depth sometimes and ask that question that creates what I call the OSM in the other one, the O moment. You use whatever word you like but that moment of oh my goodness, yeah, you know, that somebody has when they really realize something. And we get that by making the environment creative. And playfulness is such an important part of the creativity. I have a friend who's quite a well-known improv performer, but he's also a coach. And he likes to we try to find a description for his kind of coaching. We call it imagination coaching. Mm. So he goes and works with chief executives and other very senior people, and helps them to imagine the things that they would never think of imagining. And it's just releasing the creativity in them gives them whole new ways of looking at themselves, their business, their organization, their colleagues, and so forth.
And I guess this sort of speaks to that rise in creative coaching, where I see people doing art and coaching and collage and coaching and dance and coaching, where they're looking at bringing in these other mediums that help unlock the creative within us to allow us to then think beyond our thinking.
Yeah, And I think we as long as we don't take these things too seriously, you know, and we treat them appropriately, they can all be extremely helpful. I mean, there are things which are just silly. Like I've come across people trying to sell astrological coaching. Well, you know, that's forget that. But equine coaching, is at its root a very powerful thing, particularly with people who are high stress driven individuals who don't know how to get who are failing in command and control. Putting them on a horse, and a horse is not going to take any nonsense, frankly. It gives them a whole new insight into the fact that you know if you're working with something that won't be controlled, where you have no hierarchical power over it, then suddenly you've got to completely change your way of thinking and working. So there's lots of things we can introduce new perspectives.
And just picking up on the equine stuff, is there's a real there's been lots of work around the sort of the emotional connection that horses will have with the rider, and how when people work with horses, the horses are tuning into something else, or a different level, vibration, whatever you want to call it, that allows a different relationship to then exist and allow somebody to tap into a different part of themselves as well.
Yeah, I've certainly experienced that. I don't ride now, but I used to ride quite a lot and fall off.
I mean, that's part of it as well, isn't it? You know, the falling off to get back on again, and that whole relationship. And I think in coaching, often we create a space where people can fall and get back up again. They can make mistakes. They can test things out and experiment within that space, and outside of that space, without the fear that can come with testing things out without a coach or without a mentor.
Yeah, I guess the analogy that's immediately come to mind is taking a fence on horseback. You know, so if you are the rider, you're the coach, and your client is the horse. Yeah, you know, there comes a time if you take the fence but the horse doesn't, you know you've failed somewhere.
absolutely, and it's really interesting. I was just looking at my notes, and the word systemic jumped up. And I noticed that as I talk to coaches that have developed over time, they start to think much more systemically. And I just thought that was perhaps just through reading more, you start to think about systems more. But I guess there's something here about as we develop as coaches and as humans, the knowledge that we start to acquire allows us to see the world more systemically, allows us to draw the lines together from all those dots that we're noticing within our clients and the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the complexity of the issues that clients bring to us that force us to make us realize, okay, my linear way of thinking isn't gonna work here. And so when we question ourselves, then we start to look for different solutions and different patterns. And we can, and systemic thinking goes to, I mean, you start with linear thinking, then you go to basic systemic thinking. So the interaction between you and I is a system now that we've established, and so there's an interaction between us. And it's very easy to get stuck at that very basic level of systemic thinking. So when we're dealing with issues of political correctness, for example, you know, saying the wrong thing, so we can get into impact versus intent, and that becomes a system in where you can change components of that system to get a different outcome. But then you've got more broadly called systemic thinking, where you start to see the team the client as an individual client, and you look at the systems around them, so their own team, their boss, their family. So how are they relating to those individual systems, and what's happening in their relationship with each one of those? Then you get into complex adaptive systems at the next level, where you're not only looking at the interactions between the individual and their immediate systems, but the interactions between those other elements, those other systems, on each other. You know, and so we can build in greater and greater levels of complexity. And what we're learning now to do as coaches gradually, particularly with the rise of team coaching, is to be able to go into higher and higher levels of complexity in order to give you different levers. So, you know, how as a leader, if you're just focusing on changing the leader and their behavior, not a lot is going to happen if the system is working against it. But if you're only working on the leader and their immediate system, that's part of a much bigger machine. And so if you want to have the biggest impact, you have to impact the machine itself, which means that we look for different levers. And when we find those different, more powerful levers, what frequently happens is that leader recognizes the potential they have to have a much bigger influence than they ever thought they could on the bigger system. You know, you've got to get, you know, it's like being in the signal box on a railway. You know, if you're in the signal box and you know what levers to pull, you can either create total chaos or actually keep the whole thing running smoothly.
And I guess this plays into a part of where coaches will work with somebody to create change. They see the shoots of that change becoming, but then the person goes back into the system and the system pushes them back into the old way of being. And then they come back and the change isn't there anymore. And as coaches, we can get caught up in what's going on for my client that they're not shifting or they're not sustaining that change, without going, well, what's happening in their system that's forcing them back into it? So they might need to change the whole system or adapt that system to create the change, or address the system even to create the change.
Yeah, just let that. It'll be a rubbish. Okay. Sorry, do you want to do that one and get that bit again?
Yeah, so it sort of makes me think about where you know, we're, as a coach, we're working with somebody, a coachee, and they're not changing, or we see the roots of change, the shoots of change, they begin to change, they begin to shift and move towards where they want to move, but then they go back out into the world and maybe they go back into their job or back into their family, they go back into a system that pushes them back into their old way of being, and then they come back to the coach and the coach goes, well, you were changing, but now you haven't changed. And as coaches, we need to not just think about the individual, but as you were saying there, think about that whole system and explore with the client, how do they work with that system when it comes to creating change?
And most of the time, they're not aware of the system. They simply see problem solution, basically. Mm. And it's interesting, the relationship between the different levels of coach maturity. You know, we see the systemic influence or the awareness of systems increasing at each level.
Yeah.
And interestingly, when we get to that systemic eclectic level, we're not actually looking for solutions at all, because a solution is a quick fix. What we're looking for.
So this, sorry to interrupt you there. I just had a thought that just sort of jumped out at me. This thing creates a real interesting, I guess, dynamic between what one might call coaching credential development.
Yes.
And coaches' philosophical systemic development. Because when we look at coaching competencies, we're talking about identifying the challenge or the goal and working towards that. So we have that solution-focused way of working. But as we get into that sort of philosophical way of working, well, we're not actually looking for, well, what's the goal? We're looking at, well, who is this person and the system that they're sitting within? And it's interesting how these things can be at odds, and how as coaches, we have to balance our way through that as well.
Yeah. Well, I remember quite good friends with Tom Peters ages ago. We actually did quite a lot of business together. I remember him saying, competent, I don't want competence. I want, forget that, what exactly the actual words were, but I want people who are really good. I don't want competent people. And I think this, the whole point about competencies, and they are valuable in getting people started on the journey. They give you something, a bit of a roadmap to understand, well, these are the things I do do, these are the things I don't do. So we need them. And the professional bodies have been absolutely right to develop their competency frameworks. But when we get to mastery, mastery is about breaking all the rules. It's and the assumption that that each level of competence is simply doing more or more competently the things that were in the level that the previous level breaks down as we get towards mastery, because mastery is not doing that, any of those things. And I remember sitting with somebody, a mature coach, and they were going to get their the organization, but they were going to get their professional qualification at the the middle level from this organization. And they got these questions they were going through, tick box answers, you know, A, B, C, and D, as samplers. And they were reading them out, and they were looking at me, and she said, which is it, A, B, C, or D? And I was saying, well, none of those. And then we went to another question. Well, it depends on the circumstance. You know, and we actually went through, I don't know how many, probably 20 questions. I think we found about three that we could actually say, yes, there is a clear answer to that one. Now, you know, and I think this brings out when it's being done as a mechanical exercise, it has pluses and minuses. I still think we need competencies.
Yeah.
As a framework to give us a sense of what we should and shouldn't be doing. But it's that liberation that comes when you move into that third level, the philosophy level, and beyond the systemic eclectic, that we start to liberate ourselves from the basic competencies as well.
It reminds me of both improvisation, but also of sort of British pantomime. This idea in improvisation that in order to improvise and to be funny, you have to know the rules of the game that is being played, and then you can break the rules to create the humor. But if you don't know the rules, if you don't have those competencies, then it just becomes a mess. Yeah. And it's a little bit like the role of the dame in a pantomime. The dame has to know everybody's lines, everybody's parts, and the whole framework in order to create chaos within that framework. And then to pull the framework back into alignment from that chaos. And if they're just creating chaos, it just becomes a mess. And I think there's something really interesting where if coaches rush ahead in their learning and rush ahead in their development, that they get into a chaos space as opposed to that mature space. So that, you know, how do they take the time to grow and develop as opposed to have this desire, this to be there now, as it were?
Yeah, I think that's, and that becomes multiplied many times over in team coaching. But you've got to get a grounding in this. And the place that you learn, the time and the place you learn most is when you fail, or when everything goes wrong. And I quite like to give people some confidence, say, to go and experiment, to do things, because every single team coaching assignment I've had, there's been a moment in that where I've thought, I have no idea what to do now. I've completely screwed that up. And sometimes I'll say to the group, well, you know, that didn't work, did it? So what did we both learn about that from that? And sort of put it back, but to have the confidence in your own ability to take whatever happens and use that as a learning opportunity with the team and for oneself.
Well, that does come with maturity and confidence, doesn't it? To be able to go, this isn't working. What are we learning from it not working? Well, that didn't work. What do we learn and understand from that without feeling that we should know the answer? Because even though as coaches, we know we don't have the answer, we still, I think, especially in the early days, have a sense of, but maybe I should know the answer, or maybe I should know the direction that I'm going in. Whereas the more mature or experienced we become, the less need we have of that direction, the more we can kind of sail on the open seas, as it were, and see which island we arrive at, as opposed to knowing we're going to that destination there.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've admired in my work at the London Comedy School, I've really, really found fascinating is the transition that comedians go through from delivering a script to being able to completely to ad lib and work with whatever is in the room and to make things happen. And, you know, and how some of the big names actually, it's just an act, it's a script, but there's no evidence that they can actually improvise in the moment and do anything but that act and as it develops. And I think it's the ones who can just totally take whatever's happening in the room and make it and turn it into laughter. Those are the comedians who I think are the real masters.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I did a public speaking course years ago, and the one of the guys that was running it said, you should be able to pick up a newspaper and bring whatever headline is in that newspaper into your talk that day. Because if you can only do what you've written down, then there is no, I guess I'd use the word dialogue or interaction between those that you're working with and the self. And I guess as a coach, you need to be able to bring in what's happening in that moment and not be caught with your script of questions that you've learned or that you've read, and just bring those to the space, but go, what else is here? And yeah. I don't know the next question. What do you think the question should be? Or what are we getting from this, as opposed to thinking we should know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tool that I like to do as well. I'll look at the newspaper headlines and just say, how could one interpret that? And you may end up cutting this bit, but today's newspaper has got a whole front page in the Times about them going to pay out billions to take away the cladding, or the dangerous cladding from the outside of high-rise buildings. And I can just see rewriting that headline as government pays billions to strippers.
And that brings up a whole set of metaphors that we may or may not need to go into as we think about that work.
Isn't this this is the essence of coaching, is it not? To reframe.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so we've spoken a lot about coaching, and I just want to touch on sort of the role of supervision within coaching and the part that plays. I sort of guess or assume that the research that you've done has been able to highlight both the benefit or lack of benefit of supervision within that the coaching space, and when it's useful and not useful.
Well, first thing is that the word supervision is a horrible word. It's ambiguous. And also it gives this sense that somehow the supervisor is a superior being to the coach themselves. And although really a good supervisor will, you know, equalize things very quickly or do their best to do that, just that the word itself has the wrong connotations. And we're increasingly seeing people use the word metavision. It's another way of looking at it. And I quite like that. And it's about creating this safe space where you can bring the things you may not actually be sure what you're worried about. And it can be a feeling, it can be a case study where things haven't worked out the way you should, a client who's not progressing the way that you would like them to. And it's all about looking at these different spaces, the system that's going on here between you, the client, the work, the greater world outside, how much of what is happening in the client or in you is actually stimulating what's happening in the client, for example. So a good example I had this morning related to a client who's in a highly politicized environment. And not, you know, what do you do to help that client not get chewed up by a poisonous system? And the one of the areas we were able to explore very briefly was, so what about your assumptions as a coach around politics? Do you see politics as something dirty? Or do you see, have you got a more nuanced view about it? So what are your assumptions before you start? Because those are going to colour, or have the potential to colour, the conversation that you have with your client. And if you both think that politics is something dirty, now you've got a problem, because you have a special problem. So it's... What we do as supervisors is just open up a whole bunch of different horizons. And to be an effective supervisor, you've got to have a lot of years of experience as a coach, but also in other areas as well. I think it just in coaching is not enough.
Yeah.
But and you've also got to be able to recognize that you don't know everything. In fact, you can't. You're having a co-exploration. And I particularly like group supervision simply because we get the value of getting people from who had different backgrounds, different trainings, different cultures in it very often. So we can use the collective wisdom of the group to help you think issues through and client cases through, to give you a whole range of different alternatives than would have occurred to you just on your own.
Yeah. I remember talking to, I think it was Bronwyn, one of our trainers, and she was saying that, you know, supervision, it's creating super vision in the space. It's like you're putting on these magic glasses that allow you to see, as both the supervisor and supervisee, to see new dimensions that you hadn't noticed before. And I like that idea that you were saying that, what are the new perspectives that we can bring to what's happening, and how can we tease out our biased or assumptions that can exist as coaches by going to supervision to have that looked at, and how group supervision has a real power to play in that space, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm going to develop the analogy a little. I love taking my grandchildren to a virtual reality studio and playing the games. suddenly you're in a completely different world. It's fascinating, but it's only a depiction. It's not the real world, and you only see something that's manufactured for you. And what you can't see in virtual reality is your feet. Or at least maybe they've changed that one, but you can only, you know, there's a limited view. You know, you have to take the glasses off to see your feet and how you've fixed the ground. And I think it's that ability to move between those different worlds that really, one has to be grounded oneself as a supervisor in order to help the coach become grounded.
Yeah. And I think, you know, both the supervisor needs to be grounded, and the coach then becomes grounded, but also in the coaching space, that coach needs to be grounded, which always speaks to what is the work that you're doing on yourself as a coach that enables you to stay grounded and self-aware, I guess, because, you know, to notice, when are you being triggered? What's your biases, your assumptions that exist that you're bringing to the space and the interaction with your client?
Yeah. I mean, there's this great myth that you somehow you can get started off as a coach and gradually you can learn everything there is about coaching and become, and that mastery means you know, being totally in control and somehow being, you know, the best you can. But the reality is that the more that you learn, the more that you realize that you can't possibly encompass all this stuff. You have to become comfortable with not being in control of anything, with not knowing everything, with realizing that that you've got a whole shelf full of books there that you really ought to read about coaching or around coaching, which you probably would take a lifetime to really get through. And so we have to become comfortable with the fact that wherever we are on our journey is a really good place to be, and that whether that's way back when we've still got our stabilizers on, or whether we are sort of halfway up the mountain and can look back down it, but nobody ever gets to the top.
That feels like such a beautiful space and reflection to bring our conversation to a close. David, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I feel like we could continue this conversation forever. There are so many points there that you brought into the space. I was like, oh, we could pick that up and we could pick that up and we can pick that up. So I look forward to having another conversation. And just before we go, it'd be great if you could just share sort of what you're working on right now, and also how people can get hold of you.
Okay. So we're working on research projects around coach maturity, around politics in coaching. We're working on something called the ripple effect of mentoring. So trying to measure the impact of training one person as a mentor, what actually happens as that trickles out. We are launching this year a foundation based upon experiments we've been doing in schools around in various countries to create 5 million school age coaches and mentors. Because we believe that if we can give kids the skills of coaching and mentoring to take into the workplace, that will benefit the workplaces and themselves tremendously.
Wow, that feels like a conversation we need to have. So let's jump in our diaries and book a conversation about that one soon. And if people want to find you, where's the best place to do that?
I'm straight on link with me on LinkedIn. Google me. I'm on Coaching and Mentoring International or David Clutterbuck Partnership. I seem to be all over the internet. So it shouldn't be difficult to find me.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for this conversation, David. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been fun. Good.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.